Open your Bibles and turn on your brains. It's time for the Think Theism Podcast.
Can the existence of God be demonstrated?
I'm convinced that there are better arguments for theism than for atheism.
Isn't any contradiction between the existence of evil and God's being holy, good, and not?
The biggest difference, of course, winds up being who is Jesus and what role does he have?
Okay. So a cosmological argument is an argument for the existence of God that takes some feature of the universe that needs an explanation and then ties that to the existence of God. Something like a first cause or a prime mover or a ground of being, something like that. According to Alexander Proust, who is a philosopher at Baylor University, when he writes about the cosmological arguments and the argument, Leibniz argument that we're going to talk about today, he says that cosmological arguments basically have to deal with four different questions. And he calls them the Glendower problem, the regress problem, the taxicab problem, and the gap problem. And we're going to talk about all four of those, and these will help you distinguish between the different types of cosmological arguments. So the Glendower problem. This is a terrible name, but it is named after a character in Shakespeare. But it basically says, if we see some feature of the universe and we think it needs an explanation, why should we believe that there actually is an explanation? So the cosmological argument is going to give some premise that addresses this problem. And we'll see what that is for the ones that we're going to look at today here in a minute. So then you have the regress problem. So this is whether or not you're dealing with an infinite series of past events or an infinite series of past causes. So this is another way that different cosmological arguments can deal with things differently. And if that doesn't make sense yet, that's okay, because we don't really need to know this, but you'll start to see what this means once we talk about the argument. And those of you who remember the Kalam argument will see exactly what that means, right? The third is the taxicab problem. So in solving that first problem, we're going to posit some premise, right, that says why we expect there to be an explanation of some feature of the world. But then if we're going to posit something like God to explain the world, we have to make sure that that first premise doesn't also then require that God have an explanation. Because if we need an explanation for God, then it's not really God, right? So this is another thing, that first premise has to satisfy this problem. And we'll see in a minute what that means. And then lastly, if we do show that there needs to be a cause or an explanation for something in the universe, how do we know that that has any religious significance? How do we know that that actually means anything in terms of there being a God that is in any way relevant to everyday life? Okay? Okay, so it's okay if that went over your head a little bit, because you don't really have to get that to go through the rest, but for those of you who've heard these before, hopefully that will help you distinguish these a little better. So, in general, most people classify that there are three types of cosmological arguments. Okay? So the first is the Kalam cosmological argument. So this argument was made more famous by William Lane Craig about 50 years ago. But it originally came from very, very early Christian and then Muslim writers in the first few centuries after Christ. This argument, the Kalam argument, says that the universe had a beginning, and so we need some cause to create that beginning of the universe, okay? Second, you have Thomistic arguments, cosmological arguments, which we never talk about here because we're not Thomists. But basically, the Thomistic arguments say that the universe needs some ground to its being. And we don't need to talk about what that means because nobody should use Thomistic arguments. And then lastly, we have the Leibnizian argument. So this is named after Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, who was a Swiss mathematician and philosopher about 300 years ago. And this one's a little bit different than Kalam because it says that the universe requires an explanation, but it doesn't have anything to do with time or things like that. It's just about explanations, not causes. Practically every important philosopher of the last 2,000 years, maybe excluding the last 100 years, but practically every major philosopher has interacted with these cosmological arguments. So you can see some list of some very important ones who've all produced their own specific twists on these arguments. Okay, so remember I said that those four problems would help us distinguish between the different arguments. So that Glendower problem, so remember the Glendower problem is that you need to have some kind of cosmic, some kind of principle that tells you that you ought to expect an explanation or cause or whatever for what you're seeing in the universe, okay? So the Kalam proposes a cosmic principle, namely that everything that begins to exist has a cause. Okay? So that's what Kalam does. The Thomistic proposes a cosmic principle. I don't know exactly what it is. I don't care. So we're going to skip that one. The Leibnizian argument, though, proposes what's called the principle of sufficient reason. And we'll see exactly what that is here in a second. For the infinite regress, so the Kalam argues that the past is finite. So it actually argues that there can't be an infinite regress of past events. The Thomistic argues that there has to be a non-intermediate cause. So basically also saying that there can't be an infinite regress of causes. In the Leibnizian argument, and we're not even going to talk about this, but basically it argues that if you had an infinite chain of causes without a first cause, you would have no explanation for the whole chain of causes itself. Again, we're not going to talk about that really, but if we have some time at the end and somebody's curious, we can discuss it a little bit. Okay, but importantly, I think this is the thing that you're going to see first that's the difference. And to explain this a little bit better, so we have the illustration of a series of dominoes versus a house of cards. So the Kalam argument is like a series of dominoes. You have a series of dominoes, and they're falling down, and so you argue back that at some point in the past, there must have been a finger that pushed the dominoes. The house of cards, that's not what you're thinking. You're looking at the top few cards in a house of cards, and you're saying, ah, there must be a table that's holding the house of cards up in the bottom. It can't just be cards all the way down, right? Can't be turtles all the way down. Make sense? So the Kalam argument, because it deals with time, has a lot more interaction with science. This Leibnizian argument is really pure philosophy. So there's not going to be any issues of understanding different scientific concepts or cosmology, but there is going to be some mind-bending philosophy, logic type stuff, okay? Everybody good so far? Okay. So, what explains the existence of reality? So this is the Leibnizian argument from contingency. Okay, so to get this done first, I promised that we would talk about what necessity and contingency mean. So these are going to be key concepts in order to talk about this argument. So if something is necessary, that means that, well, let's say if the existence of an object or something is necessary, that means that that thing could not have failed to exist. So it couldn't be different from the way it is. Does that make sense? On the other hand, if something is contingent, it means that it could be different than it is. It could have failed to exist. So pretty straightforward. Now, who can name a necessary thing? Something that's necessary? Anybody? Okay, possibly God.
That is all.
Okay.
Oxygen? Numbers.
Nope. Ah, numbers. Okay, so this is one of the hardest things to get over at the beginning of talking about this argument. There basically aren't very many examples of necessary beings. God, if God exists, he is a necessary being. That's just one of the things, that's the way we define the theistic God. There aren't very many examples of necessary beings. if you're a Platonist, so this is a particular view of metaphysics, then you may believe that things like numbers or propositions or triangles are necessarily existing abstract objects. But there aren't very many things. On the other hand, almost everything that we experience in our day-to-day lives is contingent, meaning that it could have not existed at all, or it could have been different, right? That chair could have not existed. If Texas A&M decided they needed one less chair, that chair wouldn't be there, right? Remember I said that the contingency argument posits something called the principle of sufficient reason. So there's lots of different ways that you can specify what this principle would be. Leibniz himself said something very like, number one, every true proposition has an explanation. So who knows what a proposition is? So a proposition is just the information content of a sentence, of certain types of sentence, like a declarative sentence. So if I say, it is raining, that is a proposition. If I say, it is raining in Spanish, that is also the same proposition. So it's not the words, but it's kind of the meaning behind the words, okay? So anything that you can say, any true proposition, if it's true, it has an explanation for why it's true. That's what Leibniz said, more or less. I think he might have said every fact or something like that. Of course, he wrote in German, I think, anyway. We're gonna make it a little bit more complicated, which actually makes it simpler because we're gonna narrow the focus. So we're gonna say number three down here. Everything that exists has an explanation for its existence, okay? So we're narrowing it just to the existence of things needs explanations, not all true propositions. And that's gonna lead to the actual argument. Okay, so this is the argument. There's lots of different ways that people have written this argument. This is the way that William Lane Craig has written it and the way he defends it if he does debates or in several of his books. Okay, so we've still, the principles of sufficient reason up here, we've modified just a little bit. What we say here is that everything that exists has an explanation for its existence, either A, in the necessity of its own nature, or B, in an external cause. Basically, this is just to say that everything that exists is either necessary or contingent. Okay? I mean, those are obviously the only two options. So, second premise, if the universe has an explanation for its existence, then that explanation is what we call God. What do y'all think about that one? First one seems pretty straightforward. What about the second premise? Okay, we'll get there in a second. Does this seem as obvious as the first one?
No.
Okay. Third premise, the universe is an existing thing. Anybody disagree?
Are you sure about that?
I'm pretty sure. Okay. And if these three things are true, from 1 and 3, the universe has an explanation of existence, and from 2 and 4, the explanation for the universe is God. Probably. 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. This is supposed to be 4. So that should just say from 1, 2, and 3 it follows. Okay.
Question.
So yes.
When dealing with necessity versus contingency, none of that has to do with necessarily the result of what of the action that is happening. Like if the chair doesn't exist, that you're not necessarily talking about whether someone tried to sit in that chair or not, but simply that it doesn't.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what you're saying, but I think what you're saying is correct. You're just talking about the existence and the kind of the mode of existence of things.
Right, not how it interacts with other.
Correct. Things. Presumably, the modality, that is, whether something is necessarily or contingently existing, does not affect the way it would interact with other things. Not a priori, not on the face of it. Okay. Yes.
What's God?
Yeah, that's the question.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a good question. So when we use the word God here, and typically in any kind of theistic argument that we use, we're meaning something that is specific but pretty general in scope. So typically that's going to be an immaterial, spaceless, timeless being who exists necessarily and has the omni properties, is all powerful, all good, all knowing. That's usually sufficient to define what we mean by God.
But I don't think those definitions are included in number two. If the universe necessarily has an explanation for its existence, which I think is fairly easy to accept, because
so this argument is coming from this premise is coming from a specific technical idea here.
Right.
So not that there's any obvious reason why there couldn't be some other explanation. Although we can talk about what arguments we could give for why any explanation of the universe would satisfy at least some of those properties of what it is to be God. The reason this originally, I think the person who originally gave an argument kind of in this format, Scott something or other, what he says is that this premise, or logically equivalent to saying that if atheism is true, the universe doesn't have an explanation for its existence, which is something that's frequently claimed by atheistic philosophers. If you negate the two terms here and flip it around, that's what you'll get. So this is saying if the universe has an explanation, that explanation is God. We can say if God doesn't exist, then the universe doesn't have an explanation for its existence. So those are logically equivalent. Okay, so I think it's clear that this is probably the premise that's going to be hard to swallow, right? It's not obvious. It's not quite as obvious that this is true. And while there is this technical, philosophical reasoning for choosing this, I personally don't find it persuasive for myself. Maybe if you're an atheist philosopher who has actually said that before, that if atheism is true, the universe doesn't have an explanation, then this is a good premise. But I don't think you can necessarily presuppose that. So what that means is we need to give some arguments for this. So before we get to that one, let's talk a little bit more though about the first premise. So like I said, this is basically just a version of the principle for sufficient reason. However, people can deny this. Like, you can deny this, and people will argue against this. But to deny this principle is very, very costly, because you have to be able to say that things can happen and that you shouldn't expect there to be an explanation. So the difficulty is, how do you deny this premise without also denying kind of the underpinnings of all philosophic and scientific inquiry that humans have ever done, right? Because if things can happen with no explanation, then it's foolish to even look for an explanation, because you can find an explanation and it could just be that there is no explanation, right?
Howdy, Zach here with a quick reminder about the Veritas Forum. On February 20th, 2020, we will be hosting Dr. Joshua Swamidas and Dr. Michael Behe in conversation about God and or evolution. It will be at 7 p.m. on February 20th in Rudder Theater. Please get your tickets now at texag/veritas2020. That's tx.ag/veritas2020. Tickets are currently live and they are free. If you are listening from the future, no worries. Go to texag/veritas2020 and that will take you to an audio recording of the discussion. All right, now back to the episode.
Here's a couple of specific objections. First one, if everything has an explanation for its existence, then doesn't that mean that God needs to have an explanation for his existence? What do you guys think? This is the taxicab problem, right? So remember when we talked about that at the beginning? So the taxicab problem is the idea that you can't just dismiss the principle of sufficient reason when you get to the level that you're interested in. So we're interested in God, now we can get rid of the principles of sufficient reason. Now, if we go back to the argument, though, what does the first premise actually say?
Why is that called the taxicab?
Schopenhauer, who was a detractor of this argument, gave the analogy that you can't just dismiss the principle of sufficient reason like a taxi as soon as you're done with it. He was claiming that that's what theists did with God. They said everything in the universe needs an explanation, but God doesn't. You just dismiss the argument as soon as you're ready, or as soon as you don't want it anymore. Correct. So it's named after that, his comment.
You're talking about a horse.
What?
Like a carriage. That horse.
That, I mean, it still works with like that.
Just to help your mental image of it, though.
I want to think of a yellow taxi in New York. This is my mental
image. Yeah, we should probably start calling it the Lyft fallacy.
Okay.
Right.
Lyft?
Lyft. Oh, you prefer Uber?
Lyft is cheaper.
Yeah, Uber's better.
Okay, anyway.
Okay. So note what this. What does the first premise actually say? It says everything has an explanation either in the necessity of its own nature or in an external cause.
So because of its nature?
So what category does God fit into there?
Necessity.
Yeah, so God exists by the necessity of his own nature. If there is a being that like God, he's a necessary being. Like that's what it means. So if God exists, he exists necessarily. You know, in and of himself.
So how is that premise, like, different than saying he doesn't need a cause?
So the thing is, if we were to formulate this argument saying that everything needs a cause, and then we say, sure, God has a cause, it's just that he is his own cause, that's a problem, because to say something is self-cause is not the same thing to say that it's necessary. And this is really about explanations, right? So it either has an explanation in terms of, so the question here isn't really what caused God. It's not the Kalam argument. It's what explains the existence of God. Necessary beings just exist in virtue of what they are. So you can quibble with this. You can say that this is not a good premise. Say that there are no necessary existing things. That like that's an incoherent idea.
Unless self-causing is just logically inconsistent, because if it didn't exist, it couldn't have caused itself. So that's not really.
Yeah. So for A to cause B, A has to be logically prior to B. So for A to cause A has to be logically prior to itself, which is a contradiction. So you can't have something that's self-causing. And God isn't caused, right? I mean, being caused really does imply time. I mean, there is kind of a non-temporal causation possible, but we don't think that God was caused by some external thing, right? Like, that's not what it means to be God. If God were caused by something else, then he wouldn't be God. So that's why we say he's necessary. Now, it's possible that concept is incoherent, and if that concept isn't, like, the whole idea of being a necessary being is incoherent, then you can argue against that. That's a really tough argument to make, though, because this is a pretty standard concept in philosophy, this idea of necessary beings. Okay, so we're still talking about premise one. So that's that objection. Here's another objection. The principle of sufficient reason is true for everything in the universe, but it's not true of the universe itself. What do you guys think? So this is a taxicab fallacy, right? Yeah, the Uber fallacy. So there's a fallacy called the fallacy of composition, and sometimes people will use this as an argument against this, the principle of sufficient reason. So basically, just because something is true of a part of all the parts of something doesn't mean it's true of the whole. For example, if I fill a truck with feathers, all the feathers individually are light, but if I fill the whole truck with feathers, they could be, you know, hundreds of pounds. So they could be quite heavy. So just because something is true of all the parts doesn't mean it's true of the whole. At the same time, though, just because something, in some cases, if something is true of the parts, it will be true of the whole. So it's just not obvious, so you have to make an argument for that. But in the case of the principle of sufficient reason, the argument is not that we determine that every object that we see has a reason, therefore we infer that all other objects have a reason. It's the other way around. We basically believe and assert that all things need explanations. And yes, we see things in the world that explain each other, but that's not why we think that things explain each other. So we're positing kind of a metaphysical principle, not just an inductive law that we've learned from looking at things in the world. Okay?
You're positing a metaphysical law, right? But why can that not be from seeing individual light? Like, what you get there from looking at things and being like, everything I see is this is true of, therefore I'm going to posit this.
Like, this is a presupposition. So if you're an empiricist, so this is a philosophical position that says that you basically know nothing. Everything that you know, you come to know by observing things in the world and then kind of building models to explain them. If you're a rationalist, on the other hand, you believe that, like, let's say you're kind of like a semi-rationalist, you think that there may be, for example, certain ways of thinking that are built into the way your mind and your brain works. And so you start with these, with like the assumption that things have causes and effects, right? Do you really observe things and then learn that you have causes and effects? Or is that just something that naturally happens because of the structure of your mind? But regardless of whether or not you can kind of empirically learn these laws, we're positing the law as a metaphysical law. Like, the argument here is not that this is just some empirical thing we've noticed about the world. The argument that this is a fundamental feature of reality, and that we treat it that way in our everyday lives. We always assume that everything needs an explanation. Okay, premise two. If the universe has an explanation, that explanation is God. So remember what I said before. This is logically equivalent to saying if atheism is true, the universe doesn't have an explanation for its existence. Logically equivalent. Does everybody get that logically equivalent idea? I can give you a couple more examples to explain that if anybody is unclear. But like I also said, I don't think personally that this is a very persuasive argument as to why I should think that premise two is true. You can make a good argument for the truth of premise two by itself. And this really comes down also to the gap problem. So remember, the gap problem is the question of if there is an explanation for the universe, why should we think that it has any religious significance, right? What does the explanation need to be like in order to explain the existence of the universe, of all physical space-time reality? What properties would that explanation need to have? What do you guys think? Okay, it has to be pretty powerful. I mean, in an explanatory sense, right? It has a lot of explanatory power and able to explain the whole universe. Not necessarily, we don't really know if it has creative power, because it's not about creation, but it's a big explanation. What else? I mean, some of them are written up there. What do you guys think?
Unchanging, because if it could change, then that would bring in the issue of if it's necessary or not.
It can't be made of the same stuff as the
Okay, well, so that's definitely true. So it can't, and insofar as we have to go to the first step of saying it has to be necessary. Basically, the universe either has to have a necessary explanation or a series of contingent explanations that eventually lead to a necessary, like, at some point you have to have a necessary explanation, right? That's kind of the whole point. And if it's necessary, it also has to have a certain degree of changelessness. It can't change what it is because it's necessary. But we're not Thomists, so we don't think that exactly the same way. Well, some of us are Thomists, but the rest of us aren't Thomists, so we don't think the same way Dimitri does. Yeah, so timeless, spaceless, immaterial. You can even make an argument that the explanation needs to be an agent. So an agent is a person. So it's a mind that has the ability to choose things. Because if you have a necessary thing that is the cause of another thing, that object will necessarily produce its effect. So its effect will also be necessary. You know, in every possible world that you have the cause, you will have the effect. And that's another definition of what it means to be necessary. The only way you can have a necessary cause and an effect that is not, that does not exist in every possible world, is if you have an agent that can choose whether or not for that to produce that effect. Okay? So the idea here is that while you can make an argument that, yes, this isn't necessarily God, for the purpose of this argument, we can define God as a necessarily existent, timeless, spaceless, immaterial being that is, you know, has a lot of explanatory power and has agency. You might say that that's not sufficient to say that's the Christian God. Yeah, it doesn't say Jesus in there. But that is definitely God in the theistic sense. That's like, you know, a good portion of the fundamental attributes of God that theism posits. Make sense? So remember, what we're talking about here is this premise. If the universe has an explanation, that explanation is God. Basically saying, those properties are close enough to God that we can just say, if it has an explanation, it's basically what we call God. Okay? So here's another objection. The universe does have an explanation. The universe is necessary. What do you guys think?
The universe is God. According to the way that...
Well, but then you would have to have agency.
So apparently it does.
So now you're saying that a universe has the ability to choose, which would force it to be able to comprehend the truth back at what you think is God.
I mean, I don't think the ability to choose is, I don't think it implies consciousness. Like,
yeah, I mean, consciousness and agency aren't necessarily the same thing.
You can obviously, like, Frank, you can obviously choose things without being conscious, right? Like, my car's cruise control can choose how far to push the accelerator.
Well, that's not really what we mean by choice. If it's determined, it's not a choice. We're libertarians here. But beside that, so what you have basically said is basically pantheism, right? Saying the universe is the necessary being and has these other properties that we just talked about. Potentially agency of some kind, even.
I mean, the issue is that the universe and all of its components, as far as we're aware, are changeable, and therefore they could be some other way.
Yeah, so this is the difficulty with saying that the universe is necessary. That means that literally every quark, which is a fundamental particle of matter, every quark that exists, exists necessarily. I mean, that's all the universe is just a collection of quarks in a particular arrangement, right? Now, you could posit that there is like a mystical force also in the universe, like a mind.
The force.
And you can do that, and you could probably beat this argument if you did that. The key, though, is that there's basically no philosopher that will posit that, atheistic philosopher, that will posit that the universe is necessary. Because it seems silly to think that the universe couldn't have been different from the way it is. Just seems pretty obvious that it could have been different.
So if you're following this argument, does that mean, like, we are all necessary to be alive, like our parents necessarily?
If the universe is necessary, it seems really hard to escape that everything then would be necessary. For the same reason that we said God has to be an agent in order for the universe to still be contingent, right? If the universe is necessary, everything else depends on the universe, and everything else must be necessary too. It couldn't have been different. Like, how are you going to get differences in there if the universe had to exist the way it does?
And the universe is changing all the time.
Necessarily
moving
changing.
Around.
So you could have elements of it that are necessary. For example, like, it's necessary of any triangle that the angles add up to 180 degrees, and you can change the size of, like, the lengths of the sides. You can make it isosceles triangle, or right triangle, or obtuse triangle, or acute triangle. You can do all types of different changes to it, and you can change it throughout all time, but it is necessary. It follows axiomatically that all of the angles add up to 180 degrees. So why not say something about the universe? It's necessary that there is something, some universe, but the contents of it could change.
So this is another objection, actually. I wonder if I have that one in here.
Well, while you're looking
maybe
for that,
not.
A follow-up on Dimitri's comment.
Oh, there you
the
go.
Force is not a necessary being. It is an energy field that is created by all living things.
I don't have enough Metachlorians to believe that.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left. So I think probably, what do you think, wrap up? Mm-hmm. So there's a bunch more objections. These slides will, in theory, be made available, right? So you guys can go through and look at all the other objections and responses to them. So last thing, does the universe exist? Is it an existing thing? Okay, the universe definitely exists. If you deny that the universe exists, you kind of are denying that you should be having discourse with anybody else. To wrap up, this is the whole argument again, just to kind of draw everything together. Everything that exists has an explanation for its existence, either in the necessity of its own being or in an external cause. Two, if the universe has an explanation for its existence, that explanation is what we call God. Three, the universe is an existing thing. Therefore, the universe does have an explanation for its existence, and the explanation for the existence of the universe is God. Hopefully you can see that you can go down a deep rabbit trail in each of these individual premises. But it seems to be a pretty good argument. There's a few interesting things about this. So this argument really does answer one of the most fundamental questions that you can ask, which is, why does anything at all exist? You know, what is the explanation for the fact that things exist? If the universe does have a cause, the cause must possess many of the traditional properties of the theistic God. So we saw that. That was the gap problem. And one of the nice things, or not so nice things, depending on your predilections, this argument does not require understanding of science. It doesn't require discussion of science. Leibniz thought that the universe was eternal. So God, yes, would have caused. On that model, God causes the universe, but he causes it eternally. There's not a starting point. There's not a moment in time where God creates it. So if you're a B theorist of time, you basically think the same thing anyway. So, but that makes this a nice argument because you can just do the philosophy and not get sucked down into the multiverse or into quantum physics or any of those things that people bring up to try to derail the Kalam cosmological argument, even though that one can also be done purely philosophically. Okay, so there's a few additional references for you guys to look at if you would like. The simplest version of this argument by William Lane Craig is published in On Guard. There's a slightly more extensive one published in Reasonable Faith. Then there's an even more complex... Okay, so if the first one is a complexity level 1, the second one's a complexity level 2, the third one's a complexity level 19. So this is Alexander Proust's article in the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology, the Leibnizian Cosmological Argument. It is a tough read, and it's long, but you can get some of this stuff from that. And there's some interesting things in there.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Think Theism is made in association with Rosh Christie at Texas A&M University. We invite you to join the weekly Rosh Christie meetings every Thursday at 8:30 p.m. The views and opinions that are expressed in all of our episodes are of the speakers only and are not necessarily endorsed by Rosh Christie nor by Texas A&M University. For more information, go to thinktheism.org.